We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that you really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me this morning is Tavi Costa, Portfolio Manager at Crescott Capital. Thanks for joining me today, Tavi.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
Excellent to speak to you going into the end of the year here. And as a good majority of our listeners are metals investors, surely some of them would like some perspective on where you think we are in this precious metal cycle. So you recently wrote a thread about this, and I thought we could kind of start by talking a bit about some of the signs that show us that we aren't at the top of the cycle. So why don't you start by, you know, kind of laying out some of those signs that show us where we are to give us some perspective on that.
Sure. I think we've been struggling with gold prices, which is sort of the underlying security that kind of leads to the whole cycle. We've had gold prices hitting new highs back in August of 2020. And when we look back all the way to 2018, this was really when the rally started. And we saw kind of like a sort of 70% increase in prices, which is not usual for gold to move, at such a fast pace. It's a very slow pace kind of historic price behavior usually on gold. And when we look back all the way to even 1978, other times when gold hit new highs, usually the price tends to struggle for some period. Back in 1978, in March, we saw a decline of 15% that today looks like a blip on the chart, given the fact that gold went back up significantly all the way to the late 70s and early 80s when we saw the peak of gold, of the gold market. We saw that again back in 2008 as well, when gold also hit new highs and stayed there for another 2 to 3 months. And then it got caught up in the global financial crisis and declined close to 30%. And it was very painful at that time. But then it came screaming back up all the way to 2011 when it hit another peak. And so I think that we are, seeing some of that consolidation right now. Gold does lead and does follow inflation very closely. For those that have been focusing with the laser eyes on recently on the last 12 months of the developments that we saw in inflation, you know, if you step back and look at the year-over-year change of CPI, it's pretty clear to us that gold does follow inflation very closely. And if you think that CPI is not the right measurement, which I would 100% agree with, I think that there's a much steeper increase in gold that is likely ahead of us in the following years. And I think this is going to build on itself. You know, it's like the 70s, it's like the 60s, actually. The 60s, we saw inflation staying stubborn, all the way to the 1965, staying below 2%. And then we saw that move starting to build up on inflationary forces with the wage and salary spiral and so forth, and some other issues in the commodities market. And that was the acceleration of inflation that never stopped. And we saw higher lows all the way to the late 70s. So that's sort of the backdrop on the underlying security of gold. And now let's step back and look at the a little bit of the picture on the industry of the miners, which gives you a very good sense of the cyclicality of this.
Sorry, yeah. But before we continue on the miners, I just want to kind of go over another point on the gold versus CPI. You posted a chart, and it kind of looks like gold front ran the risk of inflation after the dip in March 2020. So do you think that it has more catching up to do to the CPI chart?
I think we saw gold front running that, as you said, and got ahead of itself a little bit. And then we saw the cyclical commodities leading the way after that. And I think gold is yes, it's, I don't think that, you know, I think if we do see a deceleration of the inflationary forces here, which I'm not on that side, I still think it's going to be a higher low from the prior low. And so we're going to see, I think, the beginning of an inflationary decade. That's usually what happens. I think developed economies are due for that. And the policy making in regards to what we saw in the fiscal and monetary stimulus compared to other decades in the 40s and the 70s is, I think, policymakers are absolutely clueless about the impact of the overwhelming amount of fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, and what would that do to inflation in the future. So I do think gold will catch up at some point. I don't have the crystal ball of when, but I think it's the time of that time of history where we do want to be accumulating assets in the space, because this is, in my view, almost inevitable that gold will hit new highs and will go significantly higher from here. I think, Tom, just to understand a little bit, there is also a trend happening, in my view, regarding international reserves. When we step back and look at the crypto markets and what's happening there, first and foremost, that's almost like one of the largest libertarian movements we've seen in history. It's this whole idea of a parallel work or a parallel world being built of a lot of individuals that have the same ideology of removing the government intervention and having fiat currencies that have no anchor to any tangible asset or anything that have or provide value. And I think that what's going to cause here is that governments and central banks are going to have to find that anchor back again. And so as inflationary forces start to build up here in the system, I believe strongly that central banks are going to have to start buying some sort of tangible asset in order to bring back that credibility. And I think gold is going to fit that role very significantly in the following years. And so that will drive part of the demand. I think we're going to see that trend of improvements of international reserves, the quality of international reserves, which is insane, Tom. When we think about it, countries have been doing that by buying debt from other countries. The best central bank assets that we see worldwide today, perceived by central banks, are the banks that actually own a ton of U.S. treasuries. That is one of the biggest bubbles we've seen as well. You know, treasuries are unsustainable at the levels that they are. It's just one side of the issue that we've had in this speculative bubble driven by central banks. And so I think we're going to start seeing that shift away from those into tangible assets like gold. And, you know, sure, we can see some allocation of different central banks buying some crypto assets. But I think gold, given its history and reliance of serving as a protective of those of monetary dilution, will fit that role in a much more significant way.
And as has been brought up many times, you know, we haven't seen the cryptos really go through a real deflationary crash or a real bear market along like a worldwide economic bear market. So it's going to be interesting to see how they actually fare in that. And it seems that that history hasn't been proven enough for governments to start to trust those assets, right?
Yeah, crypto is difficult because you have to separate two things. Number one, crypto is here to stay, just like the internet back in 90s and 2000s. You know, it was a development that really, you know, it was very persistent and stayed in. And there was a lot of developments. The largest companies today are internet related companies. And so we're going to see the same thing, in my view, happening and evolving over the years. The difference here is that we got to separate what is part of the speculative bubble. And I think crypto is part of that too. It's software and it's crypto. When we go back every 5 years, the market leadership will change inherently. And so I think that, you know, if we look back 5 years from now, I think we're not going to see software and cryptos really leading the market like we've seen so far. I think it's going to look very different. I think we're going to see things like commodity related businesses leading the market and becoming more of that, taking more of that leadership role that we haven't seen in many years. I think we're seeing part of that on policy making from other countries. I think other countries are starting to realize that and shifting away from that and trying to invest in more industrials and materials and even commodity related businesses and natural resource projects. And I think that it's inevitable that we're going to see some sort of comeback to capital allocation into commodity related projects. So yes, I think crypto is part of the bubble, is part of the problem. I think that it's very important to look at the market behavior recently. We're starting to see GameStop and the AMCs of the world starting to roll over. Those are also part of the speculative bubble. I'll give you another one. When we look at non-profitable businesses, which are mostly part of the ARK ETF members, you look at ARK itself has been doing very poorly. You look at MicroStrategy is another one that has been doing very poorly, or Tesla has been doing very poorly. So those are all signs, in my view, that something is happening under the surface. We looked at software median performance from 52-week highs. The median performance in the software industry right now is down at least another 30% already. So it's not showing in real equal weighted S&P 500. The mega cap companies in the S&P and the markets in general are masking most of that weakness in the breadth of the market. And so now I posted a chart of NASDAQ. Probably you have seen that chart of NASDAQ basically very close to all-time highs. I think at that time when I posted, it was up, was down only 2 percentage points away from all-time highs. And when we look at the breadth indication or indicators, look, for instance, the percentage of members that are above 200-day moving average, the percentage of those members is as low as about 30%. So, you know, the only time we've seen this type of lack of leadership from a very speculative industries that have been the leading parts of the market was in 2000 during the tech bubble. So I am very concerned about the equity market right now. Mm-hmm.
So Tavi, going back to, you know, this underinvestment in miners and commodity producers, you know, when we look at the commodity index as a whole, how underowned are the commodity producers and metals producers right now?
That's a very important question, because for every dollar that is entering the global equity market, about 5 cents is going to commodity producers. That is basically an all-time low right now. So we have completely shifted away from basic necessities of the economy, such as natural resource projects, to now fund a lot of technology related projects. And that is even causing an issue in universities, the lack of geologists. We are a private fund that is funding a lot of deals in the precious metals and base metals space. And what we find is the difficulty and the lack of work in, as a whole, to fulfill a lot of the jobs that we would like to fulfill. And so it is very difficult, and quality work is another issue. And the infrastructure part is another issue. So it's very clear that there has been a misallocation of capital. When we look at the CapEx picture of tech companies versus commodity-related businesses, it's a huge divergence, especially since 2000 or so, actually, or I should say it started really in 2000, but now it's getting even worse after the global financial crisis. We saw that ticking up during that bull market that was after global financial crisis all the way to 2011. But then after that, things just started to diverge significantly. Oil is another example. The number of rigs, active rigs today all over the world, it's basically at levels that we saw at other bottoms, during 2016 or even 2000s or so. It's quite incredible what we're seeing in regards to the lack of capital spending in that space. It partially has to do with the political side, the political effort to not allow development and exploration and production of natural resources is a huge part of this. And on top of it, everyone is talking about electrification. So there is a miscalculation, in my view, of policymakers to what we're going to need in order to fund most of those developments for the next few years. And so I think, you know, it is a problem. You know, it was inevitable that we're going to see some of the issues that we're seeing currently in regards to the shortage of raw materials. I think it was, you know, sure, the COVID situation has accelerated a lot of those issues, but it was inevitable we're going to hit that wall. And here we are now.
So Tavi, is it possible that most mainstream and institutional investors still believe that the transitory inflation story and that they are not interested in gold at this point?
I don't think that those are actually related so much. I think people are starting to wake up and see that this is not really a transitory problem. I think the inflationary problem is really infiltrating in the mindset of consumers in general already. But also, I think what it has to do with gold is just number one, that issue I said before, it needed some sort of consolidation before a major move to the upside. The second thing that we saw was the economy was really growing in the first part of the year. And so gold doesn't usually do very well during times when the economy is growing the way it was. In real terms, it was always also growing at the first part of the year. The second part of the year that changed where inflation really built up and the growth did not kept up with the same pace. And what we're going to see in my view at some point is that everything is driven by, very large economies worldwide. So we have two economies that have really been driving growth globally, the U.S. And really China. Those are the two that have been driving growth. And China is facing a very difficult problem right now. Their economic model of really importing commodities and then exporting final products is finally having issues because of the rising commodity prices. And it's a very largely indebted economy. So the issue with China now that is facing is, what do they do? Do they inject further liquidity in order to reaccelerate the economy with more units of debt and less units of GDP, or did they just devalue their currency or they do the opposite and do not inject liquidity and let the economy decelerate, which was kind of what we saw recently. The deceleration of growth in China and the strengthening of the yuan relative to the dollar had everything to do with the lack of liquidity initially. The question is, can that be sustainable? We don't think so. We think China is going to resort back to liquidity. We're starting to see that now with required reserve ratio of the banks starting to decline. I think we're going to see a lot more policies that are very similar to that in order to unlock liquidity in the system. And that's going to be pressure on the currency. And if that happens, it could create another wave of some sort of acceleration of growth that, again, it's not organic at all. You know, it is very much driven by monetary and fiscal policy, but it drives inflation too.
So, Tavi, obviously, we saw the Evergrande default story everywhere this fall, and some analysts were saying that it was the next Lehman moment. Do you think that was part of a controlled deflation of part of that debt bubble? Or do you think that this is continuing to spread and could it spread outside of China?
I think it's significantly worse than Lehman as far as the potential. I think it could spread to a lot of other places. But when you look at the overall debt of China today at about way over 320% of GDP, which it is one of the largest in the world. And you can say, well, but the US is too. And it is. Other developed economies are in the same spot. I think that is the real constraint of how much liquidity can be put into the system when you have inflationary problems rising. All the economic models that we've seen so far of this abundancy of monetary stimulus to drive now fiscal stimulus too. I think it's going to be an issue here soon. We're clearly seeing the signs of inflation already worldwide, and China was able to grow the way it was growing because of the low cost of capital. In other words, one part of cost of capital is inflation. And so for how long are they going to be able to do that is the question. What worries me actually is the fact that I think that we're going to see is China resorting back to liquidity. And in order to save some of the issues that we're seeing with other companies that have nothing to do with Evergrande and other parts of the economy that are very troubling, And even other parts of Hong Kong as well, too, which is more and more becoming part of China, as we all know. And the issue with this is that that liquidity that we may see in the following months or so, in order to perhaps reaccelerate growth domestically somehow. Again, it's not real growth. It's going to be driven by inflation too. And so if we see that, I think we're going to see the debasement of the Chinese currency even more. And if that happens, I think this could potentially drive some geopolitical issues, and we can see some uprise of you know, questions about Taiwan and some other problems that could geopolitically happen. I think that's a risk for the market as the next development as well. You know, there's a lot of issues, and there will always be a lot of issues, but there are a lot of opportunities too. You know, that constraint of policymaking worldwide, especially from developed economies, given the fact that we have a lot of debt, is providing to us an incredible opportunity to really be allocating capital into tangible assets, because I think it's inevitable that we're going to see not only the shortage side of it, the supply continue to be constrained, but on top of it is the need for an improvement of balance sheets of central banks, the need for the going back to having an anchor, and that's going to drive even further the price of tangible assets. I think precious metals will play a very important role into that too.
So Tavi, as we were talking about inflation, we saw the PPI numbers come in yesterday at 9.6%. Do you expect inflation to continue and be more persistent and not just dependent on the supply chain issues and shortages to get resolved?
I think what we're going to see as far as inflation is the next risk is on food prices. I think we're starting to see that. I think that that's going to be an important one because, yes, it's not so much measured on CPI or CPI lie, but I do think that what we're going to have here is an issue with the population. You know, population of food prices is something that drives consumers, especially lower classes and to poverty levels, and it's something that will drive policy making again. And so I think we'll continue to see peak inequality targeted fiscal policies. In other words, anything that can try to drive up the lower classes to become more wealthy. And that unfortunately will drive the inflation issue as well. So I think that this is all linked personally. Yes, I think that inflation is somewhat cyclical. And most of the market participants today have not lived through inflationary issues. And so this is an interesting environment right now because those folks don't know how to react to this. I think what we're going to see here is again, it could be cyclical at some point where inflationary forces may decelerate a little bit, but they will continue to grow as far as making higher lows, just like we saw in the 70s. It will build on itself, on themselves as we go. And this is going to be a very interesting setup. We'll change the entire dynamic of the market. Cost of capital will rise. Profitability will become, again, a priority. A lot of things are going to change going forward.
As you say, food prices are a very emotional part of inflation. And if we look at the upstream effects of food prices going up, we've seen fertilizer prices spike like never before. So that's another reason that we could see food prices really continue to rise here, right?
That's right, Tom. I think there is a domino effect that started with lumber prices, which went up significantly, then collapsed, and are now going back up again. We should talk about that later. But and then we saw energy prices going up significantly, and then we saw a little bit of setback recently, and then we saw zinc and lead, and then we saw coal prices starting to rise, and now we're seeing ammonia prices rising. What's next? Well, you put the chart of ammonia prices relative to food prices or agricultural commodity prices. Well, that seems to be the next part of the next domino to fall. Even though it's not going to fall, it's going to rise, mm-hmm. in our view, significantly from here. So And by the way, if you look at, you know, as an investor, the implied volatility, a lot of the instruments that are linked to commodity, agricultural commodities, are not really priced in the probability of a major increase in food prices from here. And I think it's a very interesting investment as of now until for the next 12 months or so. So we think that's going to happen. And we are actually long a lot of agricultural commodities in our funds.
So Tavi, how does the energy picture play into your macro thesis here? You just touched on it. So we've seen the oil and gas industry be really stifled and stopped at almost every opportunity in the last couple of years. And we're just now starting to suffer the higher costs associated with lack of inventories in parts of the world. So how will this lack of supply start to play into the landscape going forward?
Well, the issue with energy, it really has to do, it starts from the political effort to, you know, really prevent those companies from profiting or preventing those companies from developing their own projects. And I think we're not ready yet to get rid of oil companies or get rid of oil itself to run or function normally or the global economy. And so, you know, that seems pretty obvious, but I don't think that is, you know, really going well along with policy making. So I think that when you look at valuations of those companies, there's no way around the energy side. Energy companies are really cheap. They're very profitable businesses right now. They did not used to be 5 years ago. They're incredibly cheap right now. And when you look at the balance sheets, they're improving, but they're a little more levered than most of the other commodities. So when you buy an energy, you got to be aware of that risk. And so I think energy prices will continue to go higher. I think oil will continue to go higher. I think we'll play into part of that geopolitical risk as well. I think if we start to see some issues on the politics of China, I think we'll play into oil as well on the upside, not to the downside. So I am bullish on oil. I'm bullish on nat gas. I think nat gas, especially after this major decline we saw recently, is a buy here personally. Again, that's just my opinion, but I highly doubt that we're going to see another secular decline on top of what we just saw in the last decade of energy prices declining. I think we're going to see quite the opposite. And that's also going to be driving policy making as well. It's going to be an issue for cost of capital. Again, it's going to drive the inflationary problem as well. So there are going to be a lot of consequences, unintended consequences of all this. So we are long some energy names, a lot of the energy names, but you know, it's not as high as an exposure as we think precious metals and base metals and some other commodities, you know, deserve, given the fact that they have not moved at all. Precious metals are even cheap relative to commodities today. So anyways, we can get into that as well. But very long energy, and I think energy prices are going significantly higher from here. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to the mining side of things, Tavi, I'd like to step back a little bit and, you know, just explore the macro landscape a bit more. We have another FOMC meeting today, and Powell, of course, has been given a nod for another term. And the Fed has announced that they are going to begin tapering QE purchases. So when we get to the end of this QE cycle, as is speculated possibly by March, what is this going to mean for the bond market at that time?
Yeah, well, that's another situation that I think it's important to point out. You know, since the global financial crisis, you know, every time we had a crisis and a recession, we have funded the initial part of the massive fiscal stimulus that comes out of that downturn in the economy through T-bills, or another way to say it is short-term maturity treasuries. And so what happens after that is that there is a transition away from those short-term maturity bonds into issuing a lot of longer duration bonds. So we see a major increase in bonds and notes issuances. And this is precisely what's happening today. That's why I'm giving you some background. This is what we saw back in the COVID crash, was the beginning of the issuance of T-bills. And now after that, we're seeing a very large amount of those T-bills maturing And we're seeing a very large increase of issuances of bonds and notes to levels like, you know, over $500 to $600 billion just in the last 3 months. Why am I pointing this out? Is because the Federal Reserve is the largest buyer of all this. It buys close to 30 to 35 or even 40%, depending on the month, of those issuances. And they're saying now they're not going to be buying this anymore. So who is going to be buying that is my question, number one. Number two is there is inflationary forces that firstly were seen or perceived by some folks, investors, even policymakers, that could potentially be transitory. But are they? I don't think they are. And I think that those probabilities have changed quite a lot now. So I'm very worried about this flood of issuances of longer duration bonds and or long duration treasuries. And I think that that could potentially create a rise in interest rates here on the 10-year yield and 30-year yields. Specifically 10-year yields, I think the U.S. could see very easily a 2.5% to 3% 10-year yield, which is a very significant move from here that could, you know, that is a tradable or investable idea, in my view, that you know, we're very exposed to that as well. I think it's a good hedge on the gold. Even though, you know, for folks that like to, you know, look back and look at the relationship of 10-year yields and gold, I suggest everyone to go back to the 70s and look at the correlation of the two. They basically went up together. 10-year yields were going up along with gold, you know, and that may fit into that idea that we were discussing before of where central banks are actually perhaps not selling, you know, treasuries, perhaps not selling those bonds, but maybe just transitioning away from those instruments and buying into tangible assets to, again, bring back that credibility with finding an anchor to those fiat currencies. So it's a long answer, but I think treasuries are part of the problem, and they hold the key for the whole equity market. The whole reason why we have equities at the multiples we have today is, you know, if you would point out one reason, that reason is low interest rates. Well, what happens if they are not as low as they used to be? Do the markets deserve to be re-rated as far as valuations go? I think they should. And so, you know, perhaps we're seeing some of that already for other reasons, but I think they're going to get connected. And pay attention to those days though, when the market is down and actually treasuries are not rallying. It's quite interesting when you see that. And I think we're going to see more of those.
So when we get a combination, Tavi, of this higher inflation rate and possibly rising interest rates, could this force cash out of bonds and into the metals?
I think so. I think it's going to fit into that central bank transition. I think it's going to fit into the 60 and 40s portfolios that have completely underallocated capital into gold that I think will really become another form of protection for portfolios, which had been for many, many years. But it has been forgotten by large capital allocators, the pension funds and the large hedge funds of the world barely allocate capital to gold. And so now we're going to start seeing that the risk, the volatility will change of most asset classes as we see cost of capital rising. That's one of the unintended consequences of that. And so as we see those changes in the markets, I think folks are going to start seeing gold in a very different way. And I think it's going to fit into a lot of portfolios. So I love looking at what is going to drive the incremental dollar into the precious metal space. And for me, when I look at NASDAQ price, if you just get a chart of NASDAQ valuations or just the price, and then you put 10-year yields on the other side of the chart, they're both in a major divergence, right? So everyone has allocated capital into technology and everyone has allocated capital into treasuries. And so in order to hedge that position on the long side of the risk of being long technology companies. And so what happens when you start seeing some folks transitioning away from that crowded allocation and crowded portfolio position, I think it will be driving liquidity into some other markets that have been forgotten. And one of them is gold, one of them is silver. And that is why, if you see that move, it could drive, it could create some explosive moves in precious metals, in my opinion, like silver and like the miners. Mm-hmm.
So when we think about, you know, you've mentioned hedging your position here a couple of times, Tavi. So how do you hedge your position in the miners, considering their weak performance over the past several months?
Well, it's been difficult. It's not easy. The best hedge you can find is really buying high quality, deep value opportunities out there. I know this sounds easy, but it's not easy at all. Mm-hmm. It's really finding companies that are able to deliver results, even though the market, it's not allowing those companies to perform well. And it's been very difficult because I was telling you before even we started this conversation that there are quite a lot of companies putting out incredible results, especially in the exploration side, mm-hmm. and they're not being rewarded at all by the markets. They're being rewarded by going up by 20%, 30%, while when you look back at similar intercepts and similar drill results that we saw back in 2010 and 2009, when the precious metals market was at a bull market, those companies were tripling, quadrupling prices because of those results. And so it is almost like buying companies that have this winning lottery ticket that it's not being rewarded by the market. And yes, they go up still 10, 15% or so. We've been very fortunate to have invested in a lot of companies that have done well so far. But it's been very challenging for the entire industry. Liquidity started to come into the space back in August and even in 2020. The whole year was, I would say, very different than 2021 as far as liquidity goes. And even the deals are, you know, you're seeing companies going back to offering a lot of full warrant deals on private placements, which was something that kind of went away at the beginning of 2021, at the late stages of 2020, as everyone thought that pullback was not going to last long. But it has, you know, it has been here for over 12 months now. Who would have thought? You know, I didn't think that either. But it allowed an investor that has that long-term mentality to really accumulate a lot of high-quality assets in the space. And I think ultimately the goal is that we are in a bull market for precious metals and especially gold. It started in 2018, in my opinion. And I think we're going to go way higher as far as prices go in almost the entire industry. But it's tough to hedge. And I think we've been hedging most of our positions by being short software companies. You know, that has been one part of it. We are also long a lot of other commodities. We've been long energy for more than a year now. We started really buying energy a little bit before prices went negative, which surprisingly, the producers did not go lower during that day. They went up when energy and oil prices went negative. That was a telling part that the market was about to turn. Mm-hmm. And then we started allocating more capital into more other cyclical commodities too. So it's been a good year as far as those parts of the investments. The gold side has been very bad. But, you know, I would say we've been hiding very well relative to the overall market in the gold space. It's been challenging. But what is, you know, what is best? I think the best investment approach here is to really look for deep value opportunities and then look for hedging on the very hyped multiple and types of speculative sides of the markets. You know, and I think software has been one of those. And I think it's going to start spreading to the other parts of the market. So there are parts of the market that have not moved yet. You know, equal weighted S&P 500 index, for instance. You know, there's ways you can short that. And it's not really priced in my view, what could potentially happen in the next 2 to 3 months as far as a potential real correction in those overall parts of the equity market. So now I think there's ways to hedge it, but it's been very difficult. Mm-hmm.
Tavi, what do you look for when you're saying that you're looking for these deep value mining plays? Are there any, you know, criteria that need to be met to fit into that category?
there are a lot of things that needs to be in that in that side in order to select those businesses. I think it really starts from the team. It's already difficult enough to find discoveries in the exploration side. And so not having a very robust exploration team and good management is going to be a real problem. That is, unfortunately, very difficult to quantify. So that's one side of the challenge. The second part of it is, you know, is this place really, or this project really, going to be a world-class discovery? World-class discoveries can be bid up even in times when it did very well, regardless of the equity markets in the gold space doing terribly. So finding high-quality projects is key. You know, there is a misconception, especially from new investors in the space, of buying low grade but large deposits because they have a lot of leverage to gold and silver prices. I think that's a mistake, personally. I think almost like you're buying a company that has a high quality project by looking at intercepts that statistically show that those companies can have real discoveries. And, you know, those stats could be wrong. That they're not always right. And that's why we take an approach of owning 90 companies in our portfolio. We work very closely with all of them, believe it or not. Some of them don't follow the script, and that is when we have to divest. That doesn't happen very often, but it happens. The other thing is, I think it's important to understand the probability of a merger and acquisition of those projects and companies. If there is some sort of you got to think about your optionality very well. And so we look for very high grade discoveries in places where jurisdiction wise, we're able to develop those places, those projects without having issues with politics or some other sort of geopolitical issue. So it sounds easy, but today we're targeting somewhere close to 300 million ounces of gold in our portfolio, which is, it's a significant amount. It's an incredible amount. Mm-hmm. We've been invested in a lot of the new discoveries of the last 12 months and 20 months, I would say. Crescat has been, and we think we're going to get into, Tom, this new discovery age of gold and silver. And we hope to be one of the capital allocators that are really participating in this market in a large way. There's a lack of investors in this. I mean, I can count on my fingers how many people are actually, you know, well-rounded and know what they're doing in the space in order to allocate capital here. And so, it's difficult, but there's so many inconsistencies that create opportunities. And so we're very focused on this. And I think, you know, as far as our capital will continue to go that way, as long as our macro case becomes, it still is intact or continues to improve. And that's the case right now. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Tavi. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we do?
Well, I think it's important to continue to think about how to protect capital in this environment. I think we're going to see a time right now that perhaps with equity markets especially are very fragile. I want to point that out because the S&P equal weighted is barely down. I believe it's less than 3 percentage points away from all-time highs. The median stock in the Russell 2000 or 3000 right now, it's down somewhere close to 21%. I'm looking at my notes here that I wrote it down. And so those are all things that are going to be playing out soon. I think this is going to spread to the overall equity market, and it's going to give an opportunity to then allocate capital into the precious metal space, as I think the Federal Reserve ultimately is completely restricted from continuing to tighten policies because of the situation on the debt side and the multiples that we have in equity markets. So at some point, we're going to see that shift. And the equity markets, I think, are going to be onto some issues here in the following weeks and even days, in my opinion. So thanks again for having me, Tom.
Excellent to have you as always, Tavi. Of course, you post some excellent charts and great research on your Twitter feed at Tavi Costa. And of course, you guys are available at crescat.net. Thanks so much for your time today, Tavi.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.